As we know, three NRL clubs have been issued breach notices for reportedly failing to follow concussion rules during round three of the NRL. Notices were served to the Gold Coast Titans, St George Illawarra Dragons and the Newcastle Knights yesterday afternoon. The clubs face record fines totalling $350,000 if found guilty. Now, these would be the heaviest fines ever proposed by the game for concussion breaches. The breach notices are as follows for the Titans. They've been fined $150,000 for incidents involving Kane Elgee, Joe Greenwood and Ryan Simpkins. St George Illawarra and Newcastle have each been fined $100,000 for incidents involving Josh Dugan from the Dragons and Brendan Elliott at the Knights. Now, the NRL CEO Todd Greenberg said player safety is the game's most important issue and that the severity of the fines show how seriously the NRL take it. Well, you can't argue with that. The crackdown comes just weeks after former Knights player James McManus launched legal action over a long-term brain injury. Each of the three clubs involved have 5 business days to respond to these notices. Now, Dr. Adrian Cohen is a founder of HeadSafe, an organisation dedicated to the elimination of preventable head and neck injuries. He's Australia's leading concussion researcher, and I'm delighted to say he's on the line. Adrian, thank you for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome, mate.
It's a tough stance, but I'm sure you'll tell me it's a welcome one.
It's very welcome. I think for a long time now we've been hearing about the code getting tough on concussion, and then week in and week out we see cheap shots, head shots, the occasional high tackle, or in these day and age, spear tackles have all but disappeared. But it's one thing to talk the talk, it's another to walk the walk. And whilst not welcoming the fact that this has had to be done, I think people are now going to take notice.
And does this put the NRL at the top of the tree in terms of Australian sports in taking this issue seriously? It must do.
I think the NRL are really backing up their rhetoric with words, and that's what with actions, and that's what everyone everybody wants to see the practice put into play. Rugby Union and the AFL have said the same things for a long time, that we're focused on the players, we're concerned about concussion, but you've got to take that through all levels. If you're going to be concerned, then you have to have rules, you have to enforce rules, you have to have protocols, you've got to ensure compliance. And when people find themselves on the wrong side of the compliance equation, not doing the right thing, you have to have a, for want of a better word, punishment that fits the crime. In other words, an appropriate sanction that makes sure it doesn't happen again.
All right, let's look briefly at the Knights fullback Brendan Elliott, who received a heavy knock early in the game, which left him what appeared to be, to the naked eye, motionless. He resumed play shortly after and then was hit again in the head in the second half. Now, so if we assume there are repeat blows to the head within one game of rugby league, can you add a bit of meat to the bone? What is it that could potentially happen to a player like that if left untreated?
Well, concussion is like many other diseases that we know of. It's a cumulative injury. You can have one blow that knocks you out, but less than 10% of all concussions have someone KO'd. So what we typically see is an impact to start with, usually to the head or can be to the chest or somewhere else in the body that's transmitted to the brain. The brain then stops functioning normally, and that can exhibit itself in symptoms that the player complains of, headache or dizziness, hearing bells ringing, or it can be shown to people looking. In other words, they can be stumbling, they can be discoordinated, they can run back to the wrong side of the ruck and get in position for the wrong team and everybody's scratching their head, or they can fail to protect themselves as they fall to the ground, what is called ragdolling. And in a number of the incidents that we've now all seen repeated on our TV screen, it appears to work and see what happened. There was the impact. The players did not protect themselves as they hit the deck, and that's a sure sign that they were incapable of doing so. That's the definition of concussion. You don't need an HIA. They need to be off the field.
Uh-huh. So in relation to what we're doing on the field, to think that Brendan Elliott got into a position where he was apparently for some time motionless and then able to play again, what's been in the process that you'd like to think exists? What was let down there? What was left out? What wasn't done properly?
Well, it's all very subjective, and it starts with who saw the incident and were they able to respond straight away. And, you know, we're in elite football when there are 7 video replays and endless eyes on the game. That's the easy bit. I worry about the community sports and the schools where it's even difficult to see the impact. Mm. But we also know that the potential for a catastrophic consequence from a second impact exists. almost like lining them up and then shooting them down the first blow. And sometimes it's in the same tackle. Sometimes the player is unconscious as they're actually hit in the air or by the tackle. And then the second blow is them actually not protecting themselves and hitting the ground. On some other occasions, it is a second blow to the head later in the same game. The younger the player is, the greater the potential consequences too, in what's called second impact syndrome. And sadly, we've had several deaths in international football put down to second impact syndrome. The brain hasn't fully recovered, whether that's in minutes, hours, days, or weeks. And the second impact causes a catastrophic shutdown.
Gosh. Are the tests we do, these concussion tests you see they carry out on the sideline and elsewhere, is that enough?
Well, I think the concept of sideline testing is starting to disappear. Everybody knows that you get moved inside into a quiet environment. There's 10 or 15 minutes, depending on the code, to assess the player and come to the conclusion as to whether they're okay or not. But that's only if there's any doubt. All codes have rigid criteria that says if the player is seen unconscious, if the player doesn't move, if the player is stumbling and discoordinated from the very outset, if there's a seizure or something that's typical of a more severe injury, they go off. There's no need for a head injury assessment or a sideline assessment. When in doubt, rule them out. Remove them from play. See the incidents, remove them from play, refer them to an appropriate specialist to see whether they can come back on. Yeah. At the elite levels of the game, we're concerned about getting the players back onto the field. As we come below that, we sort of say, you know what, it's just not worth it. It's only a game of footy. I'm starting to think of that too with our elite players. You know, when I talk to coaches, you say, hey, if your star player was within, you know, 3 minutes of tearing a hamstring and then I came over and gave it at him, so what would you do? He said, oh, you know, we'd take the player off the field, we'd rest him, we'd ice it, we'd make sure he got physio, we wouldn't rush him back into the game, and, you know, gradually we'd increase his workload, and a couple of weeks later we'd get him back in. And I go, yeah. Exactly the same with concussion. Give them a chance to recover, and the overwhelming majority will fix themselves. The ones that don't need further treatment, and that's okay, we've identified that. Get the player out of danger, make sure they're appropriately treated, have the opportunity to rest, and then every code's got a graduated return to play sequence. And if the player is without symptoms and off all medication and back to where they were with any baseline testing at the beginning of the season, then we know that they are safe to return. It's all about player safety.
Wow. So given that there's a couple of teams with a 4 or 5 day turnaround, there would be players who would be potentially at greater risk having been concussed, or maybe they passed the test and are able to rejoin the field. Is 4 days, 5 days between games enough?
Well, you're either concussed or you're not. It's kind of like
that. Right.
If you're concussed, then there's a protocol that says how long you have to sit out, depending on your age and what code it is, and when it's safe for you to return. We know that in rugby union, it's a minimum of a week off. When you're under 19, it's 2 weeks off before you go through the return to play sequence. In rugby league, that can be discretionary. So it's got to come down to who you've got looking after the players, their expertise at dealing with concussion. And bottom line, it's all about player welfare. So if there are more players in your first grade squad because you're doing knee injuries or shoulder injuries or head injuries, ultimately, that's actually good for the game. It means more players are getting a shot at the top grade and getting more used to playing at that level with the bigger hits that typically come with the higher grade. If you've got to have a bigger squad, it's all about protecting the short, medium and long-term career of your players, of your franchise, of your brand and of your game, and of sending the message loud and clear to the parents that we want kids to play sport, but we want them to do it safely, and we want the codes to show that they are looking after the players, number one.
Okay, a couple of quick ones before I let you go. Here's the first of them. Should headgear be mandatory?
Well, there's not been any studies to date that show that headgear makes a difference, soft headgear. Interestingly enough, there's some new products on the market that are actually made of a different material that are being studied as to whether they can attenuate the force being transmitted to the brain. If you have less force going to the brain, you have less risk of concussion. If they can successfully show that, then we can say that that particular type of headgear should be used. At right. The moment, none of them on the market do the job.
Wow. Okay, what about this? We're playing a contact sport here. Isn't a head clash or a knock to the head inevitable somewhat?
It's part and parcel of sport, but it's not the purpose of the sport. So these things happen in all our activities. We're not going to stop kids riding skateboards or bikes. We're not going to get people out of cars and aeroplanes. We accept as a society that a number of our activities have risks. And as long as we know that, and we go in with our eyes wide open, and we understand the consequences, we can make those decisions, and we can live with those decisions. To date, what's happened is that we've tried to pretend these things didn't exist or downplay their importance, and therefore we've been sending people literally out to battle without telling them all the risks involved.
Yeah.
That's all changed. That's what education's all about.
And I probably should have put this to you earlier, but how do you treat concussion? Is it simply a matter of rest, or is there more to it than that?
Well, the bottom line is that for the overwhelming majority of people, over 95% of people, better within 8 to 10 days if we do very little at all.
Right.
There's nothing specific other than in the initial instance to make sure they don't get back into contact, that they don't have any further insults to their brain, and that means alcohol. We stop them taking aspirin and anti-inflammatory tablets in the early stages just in case it's a bleed in their brain and not concussion. And so rest and paracetamol are the hallmarks of treatment. And given a chance to recover, most people will. For those that don't, we look at their specific symptoms, whether it's headache, whether it's balance issues, whether it's visual disturbances, and we put specific rehab in place for those. For the overwhelming majority of people, treated properly, get better without us doing anything at all. So let's just give them a chance. It's like that hamstring injury.
Mm.
If we did nothing other than give it the chance to recover, it will.
Well, how amazing hearing you tell us about this condition that we've probably downplayed for too long, which now prompts me to ask you finally, do we spend enough? Do we do enough in the area of research? I know you do, but collectively as a society, as a group of medical professions, professionals, as sports, do we do enough research?
The answer to that's an easy no. We need to put more effort into this. We need to have more professional research being done at the level of the game. Ultimately, the codes, just like our health system, should be funding this because it's in our best interest. We know that it'll make a difference long term. Unfortunately, many of the decisions that are made in politics and in society these days are all short term. We need to think about the long term. We need to put the money into research. We need to understand the condition. We need to look at better treatments and better diagnosis and making sure that we know what we're dealing with each and every time our kids and our heroes run out onto the field.
Wow, Dr. Adrian Cohen, the man who founded HeadSafe, go to the web and check it out. And what a delight to talk to you. Thank you for your expertise. And hopefully, as a result of conversations like this, more of it, we can keep our sport even safer than it is now. Good to talk, Adrian. All the best to you.
Thanks very much.